Hello and welcome to The Bunker, your need to know on news and politics 5 days a week. I'm Roz Taylor. We're living in a pre-war world, the Defence Secretary Grant Shapps said recently. Are we? And is Britain's kit up to the job? With me to discuss whether Shapps was right is Ed Arnold of the Royal United Services Institute. He's been an infantry officer in the army, and after that, he worked in security and defence. Welcome to The Bunker, Ed.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
I want to unpack Shapps' words a bit, because it's always a pre-war world somewhere, sadly. The flashpoints at the moment are Taiwan, the Middle East, and any ambition Putin may have to invade Central Europe beyond Ukraine. Which of these was Grant Shapps talking about in his speech?
Well, I think he was primarily focusing on the situation in Ukraine, but putting it in a global context. He's talked about a pre-war world, and also the Chief of the General Staff in the UK has talked about a sort of 1936 moment in terms of war on the European continent looking more likely. And, you know, in times of peace, all countries tend to deprioritise their armed forces and make cuts. And that is certainly the case in Europe since the end of the Cold War. But also, you know, discretionary operations have been sort of the flavour of the day for the last 30 years. And the potential crises that we're seeing, you know, they are quantitatively and qualitatively different to anything that has come before that up until the Second World War. So this is really talking about the scale and breadth and scope of the challenge.
Let's talk about NATO, because as members of NATO, we're obligated to come to the defence of another NATO country if it's attacked. Donald Trump has said that he might well not do that if the country that's attacked hasn't paid in enough, as he sees it, to NATO. What is NATO's weakest flank when it comes to a Russian attack?
Well, I think NATO's weakest flank, I mean, it's actually conceptually, it's about unity and political unity. There's some debate about whether NATO is a military or a political alliance. Of course, it's both. But actually, it's the political dimension that is most important at the moment. You know, militarily, we talk about flanks and fronts, and what we've seen over on the Eastern Front is a significant hardening of NATO military posture since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022. So that was a doubling of the enhanced forward presence battle groups that had been there since 2016. And obviously the biggest change that we've seen most recently is the inclusion of Finland and Sweden in the alliance. So militarily, NATO is looking pretty strong at the moment, especially on that Eastern Front. And on the flanks perspective, there's a lot of increased activity in the Arctic and the high north, where the flashpoint could be there. But I think the weakest link is really politically about that will, the unity to sort of continue the NATO transformation journey. And you mentioned or alluded to Article 5 in your question. I mean, you know, on a reading of Article 5, it's not an attack on one is an attack on all. It's actually a consultative mechanism for nations to take actions as they see fit in support of an ally. So actually, you know, NATO Article 5, as it's written, is actually quite a lot weaker than people assume.
So what would war with Russia look like? Would there be a big cyber element, for example, a lot of disinformation? What would you expect it to resemble?
I mean, that all depends on whether it's a deliberate policy on the part of the Kremlin or whether it's effectively a mistake which escalates. The assumption is, you're right, that there'd be what the military calls shaping activity. So that would be cyber operations, misinformation. And actually, in Russian doctrine, they don't really have this very clear distinction between peace and war. And actually, a lot of commentators in Russia and potentially President Putin himself would actually believe that they're already at war, but they're on, you know, a lower sort of scale of intensity at the moment, which can ramp up as and when required. Whereas the Western view of all of this is very much we are at peace until we are at war. I think the main issue really is the time frames of this. The Russian special military operation in Ukraine has not gone very well. Russians have lost a lot of kit and equipment and personnel. but they are rebuilding. There's 470,000 troops now within Ukraine, and that's a lot of troops. They are not as well trained, but they're, you know, they certainly have the numbers, and those numbers do allow for the almost the first time now the Russians to start to rotate units. So into from fighting to into positions, into rear areas to recuperate, to retrain, and then go back into the offense. So, you know, they are a weakened force, but they're certainly not weak, because they've taken a huge amount of casualties already and they are still on the offensive. From a NATO perspective, there's no sort of single threat perception of when Russia will recapitalize its forces and pose a genuine threat to NATO. But, you know, the most pessimistic timeframes are around 3 to 5 years. So that sort of gives a bit of a benchmark of when Western forces think that they might need to be ready.
Talk me through a potential attack on the Arctic, because we don't hear, I think, much about that. What would that involve? You're talking about something that wouldn't be in Finland or the far north, but would be beyond that.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it's hard to isolate the Arctic as a certain sort of geographic area, because it, you know, it links in a lot with the Baltic Sea, the high north, and also the North Atlantic. But it's a potential area of concern, and it's where the Russian, primarily Northern Sea Fleet, and also its submarines get access to the North Atlantic. And in terms of NATO's defence plans, they now have these new defence plans. So one's in the north, one's in the east, and one's in the south. But critically, there's a transatlantic reinforcement plan, which is for the US to come to reinforce European nations in a potential warfighting scenario. So obviously the risk there is that, the you know, from a Russian perspective, would you rather fight Americans on the battlefield with all of their equipment, etc., or would you rather target them coming across the Atlantic to reinforce Europeans? So there's a real challenge there to sort of provide that security. And equally, you know, if war did break out with Russia, I mean, it might not even be deliberate Kremlin policy. There's obviously options for miscalculation, which then escalate to a sort of war scenario. And the increased activity of both NATO and Russia within the Arctic and High North make that more likely.
For a long time, it's felt as though British civilians would have no part to play, active part in a war, that we might be targets, but not active participants. Is that starting to feel a bit misguided?
Well, it's not necessarily misguided, but I think we need to look at some of the evidence. And it is important to note that potential war with NATO and Russia would look probably very different to the war that we're seeing within Ukraine at the moment. But we've seen also within the war in Ukraine that, from a Ukrainian perspective, this is a societal war. It is what, you know, theorists term total war. So that is sort of all levers of the state geared to victory. And on the Russian side, it's not quite there yet, because politically, you know, Putin still wants to keep this isolated from domestic politics as much as he can. But that actual position is becoming far, far more difficult. Both militaries are really starved of those trained and, you know, quality troops that they need for offensive operations. If you take the Ukrainian example at the moment, you know, 2 years on from the invasion of 2022, I mean, the big question now is to how to mobilize. A political decision was made to mobilize older people because they didn't want to risk losing a younger generation of Ukrainian men and women, but needs must. And that is one of the big key considerations now. So I think for Western European nations, we need to really start to look into these issues and have the debate so it doesn't potentially take us by surprise in the future.
What's the state of our military kit? There have been criticisms recently of British ships and the Navy's operations against the Houthis. What's your sense of where we need to upgrade or transform even what we have?
The position of the UK military is one that we're seeing on most NATO militaries as well. So there's sort of two issues here. one that we very often refer to as the peace dividend, which was effectively deprioritizing defense after the end of the Cold War. But also the less discussed fact of this is also this going on discretionary operation, out of area operations, so Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, operations in the Sahel, which are very, very different to the potential operations that militaries will need to fight within Europe. So there's sort of a duality there that has meant that our forces are really, you know, quite underprepared. And we were found out around 2 years ago, and some mitigation measures have been made. But, you know, as an example, and you know, some of my colleagues in another team at RUSI 2 years ago assessed that the British Army had enough artillery ammunition to fight for maybe a week or two.
A week.
In Germany, it was assessed as around 2 days. And, you know, the war in Ukraine, like the First and Second World War, was predominantly an artillery battle. So if you don't have enough artillery ammunition, you effectively can't fight. Now, some of these issues are being addressed. And again, back to the point on time frames, it all depends on what your time frames are. And the key part on the Russian side is they can't fully recapitalize their forces while they are engaged in combat operations. You know, the clock starts from when those combat operations cease in Ukraine. So for European militaries and the UK, it's about making the best of what you've got at the moment, which leads you to sort of specialization. So in the UK, that's predominantly in the air and maritime environments, less so in land. And then also making sure that your investment decisions now really deliver on time and get things ready to fight as soon as possible. And that's really the debate that's happening within Europe at the moment.
Thinking about that and the role that Britain might play in a NATO where the US wasn't there to help us out, which the European Union is very much, as you'll know, starting to think about at the moment. Can you imagine European countries and Britain, and I say and Britain because obviously we're not part of the EU anymore, being able to work together effectively in that fashion if we get ourselves together in the next couple of years?
Yes, and I mean, you know, a lot of academic papers over the last 30 years have argued for this sort of role specialization. So the idea that each nation plays to its strengths, even where that is not a stated policy or written down or a formal of agreement, you sort of see it happening organically at the moment. You know, as an example, Polish military is now, you know, moving up quite dramatically through the percentages of GDP it spends on defense, with the aspiration to get to 4.8, which would make it an alliance leader. And they are spending on very land-centric, heavy warfighting divisions. So a lot of tanks, a lot of artillery, a lot of long-range artillery, you know, very much looking at what's happening in Ukraine at the moment. The UK is not going to do that because we are predominantly a maritime power. We also have very specific assets, such as anti-submarine warfare capabilities, a lot of intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance aircraft, which would very much help mitigate any US redeployment of their assets within Europe. But ultimately, NATO, you know, it is a military and political alliance, like I said earlier. So the UK, even following that strategy, just, you know, does need skin in the game as well. It does need forces deployed on the front line as a show of commitment and unity. And that's what you get through the UK deployment as the lead battle group in Estonia.
That would suggest that talk of conscription is really off the mark, because what the army, and especially as you say, the Navy and Air Force, will be looking for is skilled people. And so can we imagine a big recruitment drive potentially for military jobs, but not conscription?
Yes, and I think it's worth pointing out that sort of what's generating this debate at the moment, that was the Chief of the General Staff's comments on national mobilization in January. He didn't actually refer to conscription. But I think what he was effectively saying is that we know we have a capacity issue in multiple areas. You know, and it's not just in terms of defense, in terms of uniformed people with weapon systems, etc. It's across a broader spectrum. And really having a conversation about how we can address that. So I think it is far, and I think the debate very specifically on conscription is actually quite unhelpful. There are other options. For example, it's not about getting people in uniform, but more volunteers to, for example, the NHS or other areas would mean that the military don't have to do those roles. So the military can actually focus on their, perceived primary task as war fighting. But I think the, the general's comments in January were really we need to discuss this at a national level, and it does need to be done at a national level, led by the centre and ultimately the Prime Minister on the potential options and maybe some solutions going forward.
There is a strong sense that parts of the media like to perpetuate that we are mentally unprepared for war in this country, and that young people in particular are too woke to fight. I use the phrase in inverted commas. How quickly might, how quickly might that change? Because mindful of what happened in COVID and how quickly society adapted to the demands of the state during COVID, can you see that the same kind of thing happening again?
Potentially. And I think, it's again, back to my just previous answer then about having a national conversation about it. If we're going to do it, it needs to be soon, because we still have that institutional memory of COVID, although it is fading pretty quickly. And also the security environment is pretty acute. So taking those two things together, it is about having a discussion and, also collecting some data on this. I know that you're referring this to the sort of too woke to fight. I mean, the only sort of data I've seen on that was a pretty, quick snap poll by GB News. Polling is only as good as the question. So going back again to my earlier point about whether this is about national mobilization, whether it's about expanding the reserves, whether it is genuinely about conscription, understanding those options would then refine your research questions so you'd get effectively better data. And we're only really going to identify all of these potential issues by starting to have a more public debate about it, rather than having it as a quite insular debate in the sort of national security community.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts. We've had nearly 80 years without a pressing existential threat to the UK, so that the majority of us can't remember what that's like. And our experience of war is through cinema and TV and video games. How would you expect people's mental state to change as war approaches?
I think it is already starting to change. And again, look at the Ukrainian example and how they consider these things and how quickly Ukrainian society has changed to meet the challenge, and also how they look at the war. If you look at polling data from a Ukrainian position, I mean, it's still incredibly high, despite the huge cost, both in terms of personnel and economic cost, humanitarian cost, etc. So I think there is an element about sort of societal resilience there. But this is something that societies need to be prepared for, and that does ultimately start, through politicians. But even it's not just societies. I think, even if we look at our own militaries, for the last 30 years, we've done discretionary out-of-area operations, primarily counterinsurgencies, which are very, very different to fighting potentially, what we might be looking at in terms of the Russian threat. I think one of those areas which is pretty critical is just the level of casualties. That's going to be a real change. So as we look at plans for hardening up our defensive postures, we also can't forget the sort of the logistics part of this and sort of the medical support, which is happens way back from the front line, but is no less as critical.
Finally, if you had to put a figure on it, what are the chances of Britain going to war as part of NATO by the end of the decade?
I would say, the risk is certainly there, either deliberately or accidentally with Russia at the remainder of the decade. But the reason I sort of identify it as a risk, it's, something that may or may not happen. And the one thing that you need to do against risks is mitigate them. And I think it's pretty clear now after 2 years of warfare in Ukraine and all of the data and analysis that we have of the steps required by NATO and also the UK to get ready, because the more ready that European nations are to fight, the, in theory, the more deterred Russia would be from that fight. So I think we do understand what we need to do. It's more a question of timeframes. Unfortunately, the best way to speed up all of this transformation is funding. So without that investment, I'm not entirely sure that the UK can transform as quickly as it's needed to, given the current security environment.
Sobering stuff. Thanks so much, Ed.
Thank you.
You can support The Bunker in a small way. It's as little as £3 a month, by searching for Patreon Bunker Podcast. That's what keeps us going, so we're really grateful for your support. I'm Ros Taylor, and thanks for listening.
The Bunker was written and presented by Ros Taylor and produced by Eliza Davis-Beard. Audio production was from Robin Leeburn, with art by Jim Parrott and music by Kenny Dickinson. Managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and The Bunker is a Podmasters production.